Today is the 20th of June, 2012. I'm sitting at my kitchen table with Rachel and Jack Brass, who I've been married for 41 years, met each other at 15 years old. What I would like to start with is first to say thank you very much for coming and for being willing to share your history of being in this neighborhood. I'd like you to both start by telling me where you lived and the years that you lived there, please.
I lived at 38 Borden Street from my birth in 1947 till the family moved to North Toronto in 1956, October 22nd.
Oh, you remember the exact date.
Remember the hour.
Okay. And Rachel?
And my name is Rachel Brass. I lived at 181A Major Street from 1953 till 1962, when we moved to 411 Markham Street for 2.5 years, till about 1965.
So when you first moved, you didn't go very far from this neighborhood?
No, we stayed in the neighborhood.
Right. Do you know, I mean, you were very young when your families chose to live here. Do you have any idea why they chose to come to this neighborhood?
It was well before I was born. I know my father, through looking through some records, lived at 40 Borden Street. I don't know how long, and I don't know when he bought 38, but it must have been very early on when the house was relatively new.
Mm-hmm. So you don't know, never talked about why they chose to be here.
No. It was a Jewish neighborhood.
Well, that's a big one.
Yeah.
Were your parents immigrants?
Both my parents were immigrants.
Okay, so they would come where they had Landsmen.
Well, my father was only about 7 years old. So
his family chose to be here.
No, they actually lived down in Cabbage Town. Mm-hmm. And also before that in the ward. They were impoverished. Mm-hmm. So, and my father was an orphan at age 18.
Ooh.
With two younger brothers. So he had a very difficult early part of his life.
So when you talk about impoverished with no parents to care of that, right?
Yeah.
But he's the one who eventually bought the house on Borden.
Right. He was, he must have been in his late 20s when he bought the house.
Do you know who lived in that house at that time?
No.
Mm-hmm. And your father bought it with tenants and... Did he move in shortly after that?
I don't know. Uh-huh. I don't know what the... at one time I thought he was the original owner, but I'm not sure about that. Mm-hmm. He might have been the original owner that rented it out in order to be able to afford it and then move in at a later date. Mm-hmm. I know they lived on Euclid Avenue with my mother's parents. And I think that was up till about 1940, 1941. It might have been 1941, because I think my sister lived on Euclid, and she was born in 41.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And Rachel, what's your family story? Do you have any idea?
Not really. My parents are survivors of the Holocaust, and they first came here, lived on Kensington Avenue, 5 Kensington, in a deplorable housing, renting a flat from a crazy landlady, from what I understand, who screamed all the time at me. And it was just an unbearable situation. So they scraped up whatever money they had and bought this place. And later on, I kind of understood why when I went back to Poland to see where my father came from. We had the Harbor Streetcar ran just near our house because we were very close to the corner. And when I went back to my father's place, which was demolished, but I saw he had also a tramway streetcar running right in front of his, right near his house. So it's the same type of setting. And then I think another attraction was also, as you said, the Jewish area. There was the bakery there. There was a Harbor Fish Market. And Kensington Market was not far. My father was there every single week with lots of, and he loved to shop. And it was just a vibrant, lovely area. Also butcher shops, so you can get whatever you wanted. They loved to go up to Bloor Street for a promenade every Saturday. We would walk with our nice clothes and just walk. I have lovely memories of that.
So that was a family outing.
And I think that resembled what especially what my father lived in, the area he lived in. And I think my mother said that she used to also do promenades with her parents on the weekends. So I think all of those things combined, they love the area.
So it was familiar, which made it feel right.
Right.
And they were moving into a neighborhood where there were other Jewish families, which yes. gave them a feeling of we belong. And, well, people often like to be, especially when you're an immigrant, yeah. like to be with people of that you have something in common with. Yeah.
And there was a number of Holocaust families that already moved in, yeah. relatives and stuff like that. So.
Yeah, they knew some people. But they stayed on. Most of that generation or that ilk moved out in the mid-50s or late-50s up north, in quotation marks. Yeah. And my father always rebelled against that. That wasn't for him. And finally, when we did move up north in 1965, he was never happy because he had a car in Markham Street, but he had to drive everywhere and... it's just a different kind of lifestyle,
yeah.
suburbia. Yeah. It's just never for him. So it all comes together later on. Now I understand why they chose that place. And, of course, they had most of it rented out to support.
Okay, that's exactly where I wanted to go.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. Yeah. So when you were living there,
yes,
you lived there. How many members were there? Are there in your family when you were a child?
Well, I was the only child for 7 years uh-huh. because my sister was born 7 years later. So it was just the three of us mostly, and then my sister, so four of us. She was born in 56. Mm-hmm. So we had, let me see how many rooms we had. We had especially before my sister came, maybe two or three rooms. That was it. We had... is now the dining room. That was my parents' bedroom. Uh-huh. It's a lovely room. We had the kitchen, and there was a beautiful breakfast nook. That was our table and chairs, and there was a little bed there for me, kind of a pull-out couch. That's where I slept.
So you lived in a small space. You and your parents
yes.
lived in a really small space.
We did.
On the first floor, the
yes.
main floor.
Yes.
And
everything else was rented out to pay the mortgage.
Do you have any recollection of how many people were there? Individuals, family?
We had a family upstairs that parents and an older son. We had them there for a while, and there was also an extra room rented out to a single guy. I think mm-hmm. his name was Eugene. And we also, I think before them or after them, I can't remember the order, there was a Hungarian couple, an older couple that came. Very that used to make apple strudel for me and used to sew suits for me. I remember that she was a very talented homemaker,
yeah.
lovely woman. Shola Nini and Shola Bachi, I remember them very well. And downstairs we had a lovely rec room.
Downstairs, you mean in the basement level?
Yeah, it was built, I think our home was a builder's home. Mm-hmm. It's a newer home, and it had one of these floors that had musical notes on it. It's really cool with a little bar. And we had that rented out to an older lady, an English lady called Mrs. Seymour. She lived down there. And we had a little bathroom downstairs, just, you know, a very small one, sort of toilet and sink. I guess she used that. And we used that too occasionally. And then a washing facilities down there, washer, wringer washing machine. And then my father worked in the back room. There was a sort of a dark room, and he worked on sewing. He put fur pelts together to make a few extra bucks. So he was always down there trying to make
so
a few extra bucks.
Every space was used.
Every space.
Yeah. What kind of work did your father do when he wasn't doing pelts downstairs?
He was a furrier.
He was a furrier. Working for somebody else?
Yes, but it was very seasonal work, and he was often unemployed. So they used him, you know, as the fur trade goes for a while. And then, so they really struggled. And...
But they bought this property
yes.
and they filled every space
yes.
with bodies and paying bodies.
Exactly. I remember once they had a woman there and she didn't pay her rent. And I remember going with them to try to collect it. I remember her name was Linda. And I remember it was very upsetting for my parents that she just skipped out. And I do recall that.
And it shows how significant it was, if you recall it from decades
yes.
ago. But
yes.
it was so meaningful for your family to not have that income.
Yes, yes. They came with a little bit of money from Germany because mm-hmm. my father had worked there after the war. And so that's why they had, that was their little sort of nest egg, which they pretty well all put into this house. So that's how they were able to afford it so early. But in order to keep it up, right, keep up the bills, they had to rent out every space. But we were fine. We didn't mind it.
Yeah.
Just used to it.
Yeah, I think, what about your family? Were there extra people, or did your family fill the space?
Yeah, there's one sort of similarity between Rachel's parents and my parents. Our fathers, in those days, it was a man who made the money in most cases.
Yes.
Both of our fathers didn't know how to make money. They made a living, at best. But what they did is they knew how to save money.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So thrifty.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. So any monies they accumulated wasn't, it was due to extreme thrift. And we lived in a house that was probably, downstairs, semi-detached, small, semi-detached, probably around 500 square feet and 500 square feet upstairs. And my parents' bedroom was the dining room. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And for the first part of my life, I slept in the back of where the kitchen was. It was sort of like that room there. Mm-hmm. And my sister lived in the front room upstairs. She had the best room in the place. And I thinking of it now, I didn't think of it until now, because... and then there are two back rooms upstairs were rented out to usually couples. Mm-hmm. And I remember about three or four couples. I remember five couples, as a matter of fact, going back to the very early 50s. And occasionally, on and off, they'd rent one of the rooms upstairs. And I remember a few tenants who lived upstairs. And then I moved up when I was about 6 years old to that room upstairs. The basement wasn't finished, so they didn't rent out the basement. And my father always had a job. He worked for the same company for about 40 years. Yeah. And
so he was reliable.
Oh, my father was, my father was reliable. And he was extremely risk averse. Mm-hmm. I remember recommending to him to buy RSPs. He might have saved $150 a year, but $150 a year back in the late 60s was more than a week's work for him. So finally I convinced him to do it, and I said to him, with Canada Trust I can get this percent. And he says, no, I won't go with Canada Trust. I says, why? He says, I only do my business with Commerce. I says, why? What's says 1923, the Home Bank of Canada went bankrupt and I lost $13.
Oh, so he learned his lesson.
It was a whole, I look at it and I don't know how they adjusted to that thing, but I adjusted. I didn't know that we were, I wouldn't say impoverished, we're not, definitely not impoverished. I never missed a meal. Everything was budget, and the many times I had hand-me-down clothes, but when my mother died, I was surprised that there was a couple $100,000 in cash. I couldn't figure out where she got that from.
So what do you understand about that?
Saving.
So their internal message system was, we're poor.
Yeah.
And you can never be what they would consider extravagant.
Yeah.
They,
no.
It's a barrier.
No. We rarely went out to restaurants. We never traveled. We went to Montreal because my father had a brother who lived in Montreal. As far east we went, and far west we went, as my mother had a cousin in Buffalo.
Yeah. wouldn't call them meal traveling. Yeah. But so, both your families packed a lot of people under the roofs after your families bought those homes in order to help pay the mortgage.
Yes. Exactly. Exactly. And
it sounds to me as if it was the norm, so nobody felt sorry for themselves.
No.
They were using what we consider a living room and a dining room, which are nice to have, practically essential. There were beds and dressers and people sleeping there.
Do
you know how many people use that one washer?
Yeah, that's another issue.
And I never had to wait for the washroom, from what I remember. Mm-hmm. It was never, ever... I was never unhappy about the situation. My mother was, but I wasn't unhappy. But I thought everything was just fine.
So one bathroom, what about kitchen and refrigerator?
We had a kitchen refrigerator on the main floor, and there was an ice box on the second floor with a stove.
Oh, so they had a little bit of a kitchen upstairs.
Yes, yeah, the first room was a kitchen, the second room was a bedroom.
And same you? With us. Mm-hmm. We had a little kitchen upstairs that probably was built in there for... you know, to accommodate renters.
Right. So you didn't, you shared the bathroom, but you didn't share the kitchen.
No, we had our own kitchen, sort of a galley-style kitchen, very small. But I remember with the black and white checked, you know, tiles or whatever it was. And distinctly remember that. It was a small space, but well used. And we had a small table there, so we ate our, just a, you know, quick bite there, but we would always eat our dinner in the breakfast room. And my mother entertained a lot. She was always entertaining and cooking and baking. Did it all. And of course, air conditioning.
With no dining room. No air conditioning.
No dining room.
No living room.
No. The living room later on, actually the living room we started to use. I think in the, probably about 1955, I think just before my 54, 55, before my sister was born, and they bought some really nice furniture. I remember these. I wish I had it today. Yeah. Turquoise couches, and they had the mantle. They had some really nice old elephant sculptures and cool coffee table.
What about that cigarette glow?
A cigarette holder that opened up to say, which I still have. It's broken, but I kept that. I insisted on, because that's my youth. And, you know, they'd have cigarettes in there. People would come, and, you know, just like you put out candies today or nuts, have a cigarette. You know, of course, ashtrays out. That's what everybody did. Yeah. So that's actually a beautiful space. And I've been back to the house since, and it's been gutted completely. So there's very few, you know, remnants of what I recall, but just the odd thing in the basement.
One of you mentioned the washing machine, the Ringer washing machine.
Right.
What are some of the other memories that you have of the interior of the house, including the heating system? And you also mentioned, one of you said, no air conditioning.
Yes. No. Not only that, I never felt hot.
I remember feeling a little hot once. We had our cousins come from Israel, my mother's sister, who had one sister that connected after the Holocaust. She came in 1959 with her two daughters and her husband, and they stayed with us. There's another story for, I think it was about 6 months, something like that. Unfortunately, my parents are both gone. I can't ask them. I can ask my aunt. She's still around. Let's see if she remembers. And we all stayed there. And I remember a couple of times, because they came in the summer, feeling the heat, and I shared a bed with one of my cousins.
So those bodies warm each other up, right? So you're talking about a twin size bed with two.
Well, it was actually, it was probably more of a double. It was a couch that opened up. I'd say a small double, you know, but very small. So I remember feeling a little hot in those days, but you know what? It wasn't anything terrible. We'd go outside. We had a backyard. We'd go outside and relax. We'd play in the laneway, which was right beside our house. Everybody hung out outside. Yeah. We just stayed out.
Yeah.
That's what we did.
You're talking about so many things that I want to concentrate on.
Okay.
Okay. So let's start with, you mentioned it, we'll start with the laneway.
Mm.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
So if both of you could talk about the laneways and how you use them.
Okay. There were two laneways that I was familiar with. One was my Borden Street, Croft Street, which is just behind here.
Yes, it sure is. Yeah. Right there.
Yeah.
the other one was my grandmother behind on Markham Street, and that was Markham Street between Ulster and Harvard was one time a very high class area. It's now it's very very expensive again. But going to Borden Street, I remember you were asking, you wanted to know about the laneway. There were two, when I was, I can remember two people still had horses.
Oh.
Okay.
Yeah.
And on Markham Street, there was one guy that still had a horse, right up to probably 1960, 61.
These horses were used for?
Well, they were used for work. The guy on Markham Street, he was a fruit peddler, fruit and vegetable peddler, and he had a flatbed dray, and he would sell produce from his dray.
Dray?
Yeah, a flatbed cart.
Yeah.
And then there was, on Borden Street, there was Louis Mandel. Nice guy. He died young. And he had a horse, and he delivered fruit and vegetables. And I remember the manure guys shoveling the manure out of the stables onto the truck to take it away. So,
where was the stable?
The stable was on Croft Street.
So just down this lane somewhere,
yeah,
closer to college.
Where? Yeah, close to college.
So we're just a 3-4 minute walk away from there.
Yeah. And you could see in the old, well, the days when I was growing, you could see the stables, because the stable had, like, our, on Borden Street, behind our house was a garage, but it really was a stable. You could see the partition where the horses were, or a horse was, and upstairs was a hayloft. And you could still see, occasionally, very rare now, the hayloft and see where there were stables. Okay? And on Markham Street, they used to have blocks, concrete blocks, beside the curb. And they got rid of them because when you parked your car, you couldn't open up your door if you parked adjacent to the concrete blocks. What they were for is when you wanted to get off of your buggy, the ladies could dismount.
Oh, they didn't have to jump down.
Yeah. Yes, it was a fairly high carriage.
Sure.
And then another thing, speaking of horses, there was a, I know this is slightly out of the area, this is at Spadina and College, on the southeast corner was a very unusual trough. I only knew two in Toronto like it. It was cast iron. It was quite big. It was about the size of this table, maybe a little bit longer. And water was flowing, and a little sink was there. Water was flowing right out of a spigot, and you could go and drink the water. And then the overflow would go into a bigger vat, and the horses would drink from that side. And that was right on a horse on the curbside.
So that was in the early 50s.
Yeah,
that was
I remember that too. Yeah.
I remember that too.
Yeah.
So that was right. I think they demolished it in, what would you say, late 50s, early 60s?
Yeah.
It was quite clever when you think that human beings could drink from it, and then the horses got the rest of it.
It was a gorgeous structure. It's too bad that they got rid of it.
And kitty corner from it was the old building of the present CIBC. And it was an old building, probably from the 1880s or something like that. And on the windows, it had gold leaf Yiddish lettering. And it would say, safety deposit boxes.
In Yiddish.
Checking accounts in Yiddish.
So that's where the current CIBC is.
Yes, right, exactly.
Yes. Did we see that, or did we see it?
No, I remember passing it by many times.
And did you show it to me? I can't remember now.
No, I think it was gone. Well, maybe I think it was gone by the time.
Maybe I saw a photo, but he's told me about that.
Yeah, in gold leaf letter. It was beautiful. And then I was so sad when they wrecked the building and that disappeared.
Oh, that was remarkable. We hope to have somebody work with us at some point if you trip. And that would be wonderful if we could find pictures of that, because I'm sure your family didn't take pictures of it.
No,
there must be some somewhere.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, but I know I have seen that, and I don't remember where. So probably in a photo.
So it was Yiddish lettering, yes. English words.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Transliteration,
which, yes, yes,
the same as the Mendel's Dairy.
Yeah, no, but that's in Yiddish.
That's right in
Yiddish. Yeah, Frische Butter and Eier.
Yeah,
Yeder Tog.
Yeah,
Yedem and Tug. Where was Mendel's Dairy at that time?
Oh, that was Kensington. That was on the other side of
On Baldwin.
On the other side of Spadina.
Have you seen that? Because I think it's still there.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, okay. I have.
Yeah. Now on the end of this street. Mm-hmm. Corner
Borden Street.
Borden Street. Mm-hmm. Borden College on the northeast side, as I mentioned to you, which is now a pizza place, was the Koffler's first drugstore. Okay. Mm-hmm. Marie Koffler.
So his parents?
His father owned the drugstore, and then Marie Koffler took it over. And I would go in and Marie Koffler and ask him for a Mellow Roll.
I remember the Mellow Roll.
Right?
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
And here was...
Six cents.
Yeah, yeah. He would pull out pull a cone out of a thing, put it on, undo it, and then lift the lid off. And then across the road there on the other side...
Was it called Koffler's Drugstore? What was it called?
I don't remember.
Uh-huh.
I don't remember.
But it was the Koffler. Mm-hmm. So Murray worked in his father's store, is what you're saying.
Yeah, but he became a pharmacist as well.
Oh, yes. Big time.
So, yeah. And across the road was Stancer's Bakery, a Jewish bakery. And then you go back on the other side was an Italian produce store called Tabando's in a Jewish area. And then there was, you ever heard of the Bellevue Movie Theater?
I've heard of it, but I don't know where. Was it on College?
On College, you know where Bellevue tees off to College? You got Bellevue, here's Bellevue there, then College is over here.
Uh-huh.
Bellevue Theater was right at the T junction, right at...
But where is Bellevue, though, between what
streets? Where the fire station is.
Oh, okay, got it.
Okay?
Okay.
Okay, and that was Bellevue Bellevue Theater. And the Bellevue Theater was 10 cents on Friday. On Saturday.
Was that a movie theater or a live theater?
Movie theater, yeah. 10 cents, and you'd line up at 12 o'clock. And for 10 cents, you saw two full-length movies and five cartoons. And it was all kids, of course. And it was a great deal because my father would give me 15 cents or 20 cents. Send me off, and he'd be rid of me for
5 hours. Babysitting. I had the same experience.
Yeah.
Yes. You mean going to movies and staying there for 4 hours.
Yeah, exactly.
It was a beautiful theater, too. It wasn't a junky theater. It was built as a theater.
Mm. Oh, it was built as an actual theater.
Yeah,
so it had some old-time elegance.
Gorgeous.
From what you're saying.
It had the marquee, and it had the ticket box outside, similar to what the old one.
It's okay. No problem.
See, there's one other thing that Rachel and I remember, which is really funny. Corner Ulster and Bathurst. There's a little store right on the corner, on the northeast corner.
Oh, yeah.
And Rachel and I remember that it was at one time McGilvery's Pharmacy. And I thought the guy didn't like me. But when you went in there, he was a small, gray-haired guy, pharmacist, and with glasses on. And he never smiled. And when I go in there, I was intimidated when I go in for a chocolate bar or something. And he scowled at you. And then many years later, I'm telling Rachel about it. I said, I had the same feeling. He would scowl at me too.
I bought my potato chips there. Hostess potato chips. That's when I lived on Markham near Elston.
So you took it less personally.
It wasn't just
he
you.
Was just a scowler.
Yes.
It wasn't
yes.
a happy man, no. So that's right, McGilvery's.
Yeah.
But getting back to the laneways, I don't have that many memories of the lane. I mean, those horses I don't recall, but all I remember is it was another world in there. And it was just next door to our house. Like we lived literally between... two houses, and there was a laneway between us. Mm-hmm. So it was right there. And that was our spot. We'd go outside, you know, we didn't have holidays either or anything special to do. And we'd be out there playing, see who came. We'd be exploring. And my sister remembers something about finding some bones or something there once. And they thought it was a human body. She you know, yeah, she's younger than
imagination.
Me. Yeah. And they all said, oh, it was a, yeah. So that I don't recall. And she had
were they all paved? When you were playing in the lanes, were they paved?
Yeah.
They were.
They were paved. Yeah, I think so. Oh, no, I do remember some dirt. No, I think ours was dirt.
Quite a hard mud.
Maybe. Yeah, ours was dirt. And we had a little garage at the end, which, of course, my parents rented out because they didn't have a car on Major. So we had a garage, so cars...
A little more income.
Yeah, we had a lovely little backyard. And I also remember playing ball outside, like in the laneway. We had a wall there with our ball. And because I was the only child for so many years and my mother, you know, what was I going to do? So I'd play there for hours with that ball, ordinary movings and... all sorts of things. And people would come around. There was all sorts of kids down the street that we all got to know. We knew, and that was the other thing, we knew who lived in each house. And you had your own little area.
Yeah.
So my area was basically from Harbord down to Sussex. Mm-hmm. That was basically my area. Sometimes I moved over to Brunswick or, you know, over to Robert, but that was my little world. And we remembered who lived there and what they were like and all sorts of characters. And I remember we had an Italian family a couple of doors down, and I'd be playing with the boys outside and they'd invite me up for spaghetti, pasta. And I thought, what is this?
Worms.
It was delicious. I thought, wow, they had me. And because first I was just, you know, waiting for them to come out and play again. And they said, no, have a little bit. I thought, we didn't know from that. So it was just totally another world.
So it was exciting. Food, you were introduced to Italian food. Yeah.
Yes, just for that family.
Well, and that, I want to talk about it so much, but you're saying that the families, the children played with each other, even though you were different religions.
Absolutely.
The religions, different backgrounds.
We had a black family next door, and I think they lived there until the 70s, the Baileys. Mm-hmm. So there were two brothers, Vincent and David. And Vincent was my age. He was my friend. I played with him all the time. I remember going into his house, which was very different from mine. It was kind of the original house and very little done to it. And, you know, because my parents always painted and fixed up the house, and that was... probably from the 1880s, 1890s, the original. So Vincent was my friend. He was a great guy, but his older brother, David, would be very mean to me. And I think he hit me a couple of times going down the street. And my mother told me the story that she came up to him and gave him a threat and said, you know, basically, if you ever touch my daughter again, I'm going to go and tell your parents and you're going to be in big trouble. And she said, after that, every time David saw me, he'd run to the other side of the street, wouldn't even look at me. I don't even remember him hurting me or any of that, but I just, obviously, I'm sure the story's true. So that's how they handled it in those days. And
So they didn't worry about bullying? They
just
charge?
And charge.
Yeah, there were always bullies. There were bullies. He was a big bully. Yeah, what did he want from me? So that's a sort of an interesting comment, but there was another girl across the street. I think her parents came from California, and my father wanted to introduce me, so he took me actually over there. And she had I think they had the whole second floor. It was very, very nice, and she had a dollhouse, and that was my first introduction to dollhouses. I didn't know about that. I love that dollhouse, so I'd go over there pretty well every day. We play dolls.
Can you picture it as if you're standing in front of it at this moment?
Sure.
Is it that clear to you?
Yeah.
It is.
Yeah. Yes. I don't know. I think her name was Janet or Janice, and she moved away a couple of years later. But I remember my father taking me over there. I was a little bit shy. And they were, you know, because I didn't have a sibling, and they wanted to make sure always I had someone to play with. But I remember going over there. And then I remember once going myself and crossing the street and almost being hit by a car. That I remember.
Yeah.
Because, you know, there were a lot of cars in those days, and I remember my father, my parents coming out and going nuts, like screaming and yelling. And
At you or the driver?
No, at me. Uh-huh. At me. The driver stopped and he apologized and just said, you know, she just came out. And he was like literally this much from. And my main thought at the time was all the neighborhood kids came out because this is a big thing. And they heard the break, the screech and the yelling. And my main thought was, I'm so embarrassed in front of my friends.
Oh, how old were you?
Probably about six, something like the five, six, seven, you know, around there.
You learned a lesson the hard way.
I really did. My parents hauled me
sometimes
in there.
Sometimes it's the best way.
And after that, I was very, very careful. So yeah. Thank God.
Yeah.
Oh, these, you know, childhood memories, but they're vivid, right?
So you... used the lane a lot. It was a real playground for
absolutely.
You.
But her lane wasn't like the Croft lane. It was beside the house.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Yeah.
The lanes that, like, I remember the lane as being a little bit mysterious, a little bit more dangerous, a little bit more adventurous.
Yes, yeah, that was true too.
Yeah.
I do remember that.
And you'd go in there and you could get away with things that you'd...
Yeah, you'd like what's out there, yeah.
We have firecrackers and whatever your parents find you out. And we did one thing, we'd climb up in the garage later on when I was about eight or nine, and we'd jump from garage to garage. The imagination would flare up with the laneway, where it didn't flare up in front of the house or down the street. And as Rachel said, you had your area, and when you went beyond the bounds of the area, you were, early on you felt uncomfortable. Later on, when you were a little older, you started to feel more emancipated as you've been further and further and further. I'm an adult. Mm-hmm. I remember the first time I took the streetcar by myself. I felt like a real big guy now. Yeah. Big boy.
How old would you have been approximately?
I must have been about 7 years old.
Well, not too many parents let their children do it now at 7 years old.
You know, and I don't understand that, because I don't think things are any less safe now than they were then. That's my opinion.
I share that. I agree with you. I think it's more cautious, and because of radio and television.
The media has played it up, yes. But there were always predators out there. And But I remember the same thing with the streetcar, just before I forget my thought. So we had that Harvard streetcar, as I mentioned. Mm-hmm. And my parents got me into piano lessons. My father would take me down to the Grange, where the art gallery is. There was a Grange, and there was a teacher there. I think her name was Edie. I think Susan knows her from the bakery. She was friends with Ruffy. Mm-hmm. And so he would take me every Saturday morning, or every second, I don't remember. And it was really nice. And I was very attached to my dad. You know, it was very, we looked exactly alike, and I was his first child.
Come on, you were better looking.
So anyways, we had a very special bond. So when I left those times, and then all of a sudden one day, I mean, you know, the guy must have been exhausted from working all the time and, you know, working, you know, trying to help my mom. My mom was a little bit sickly. So he, one day, he just said, you know what, I think you're ready to do it yourself. I said, what?
And you were approximately what age?
All about the same age, I would say, about seven. And I said, I remember being terrified. And he was a very calm person. He said, you can do it. I'll take you over. I'll tell the driver where you should get off. You can do it. And I remember having my piano books and just being so fearful. But he did take me over, and the driver was very nice. And he said, you sit near me, and I'll announce the stop. Make sure you get off. And after that, I was fine, but I do remember that that initial outing. You know, it's, I guess, like the first time you drive a car or you're on an airplane or something. Those are the things you remember. But it was very handy to have that college streetcar, that Harvard streetcar there.
There's no more Harvard.
No, it's a bus. It's a bus,
and it goes right to. It goes along Wellesley, takes you right into the station at Yonge Street.
At Yonge, so you know, it's handy.
Amazing. You know, the feeling, like, we knew everybody on every house. We knew all the kids. I mean, there was no such thing as a kid not being brought in and being part of the group. Mm-hmm. It was all 100%. And it wasn't, It wasn't that we attempted to do that. It was just that that's the way it was done. And we played baseball in one of the most ridiculous places in the world, in somebody's backyard, in a laneway that we don't know who ever belonged to. One story I have to tell you. I think you'd like this story because it's got a lot of depth to it. At least I think so. They used to, Borden's Dairy delivered milk on a horse and wagon here, probably up to about 1961. I know 1956. I remember my mother telling the Borden's Dairy driver that we're moving, and to stop the milk delivery. And the way they used to do it is used to buy these tickets. Do you remember that? You'd buy these tickets, and you'd put out an empty glass bottle, and you have the tickets bent around the
inside of the lip.
And they'd come in and replace the bottles with what you put out.
In the milk container, what is it called? That
milk chute? No, we didn't have
that. Not milk chute.
We didn't have it on the veranda.
Okay.
Beside the front door.
Okay.
You just lined things up like that.
Yeah. Okay.
And anyway, there was one guy, probably so 1968, 69. His name was Percy, and my father knew Percy. And he was the last guy to have a horse and buggy delivering milk. A Jewish guy. And the Borden's Dairy Stables was on College Street, and this is important, College Street near Spadina on the south side of the street. And I remember walking by, and you could smell the horses and the manure, and you see the horses in stalls, and sort of a diagonal thing. And then one day the horses are gone, and there's trucks in there now, okay? But Percy had one horse in there, and they allowed him to keep his horse in that one stall. So I said to Percy, why don't you get a truck? Be modern. And I was maybe 16 years old, 17 years old. Maybe no, I was probably older. And he said, trucks are no goddamn good. And I cannot figure how he's going to justify that. But he did. He justified it. What he said is, when I load up my tray of product and I deliver it down the house, the horse follows me. With a truck, I have to backtrack. So I can do my deliveries a lot faster. And he said, and besides, on Friday, I finish my route early and I keep a bottle of whiskey behind my seat, and I get myself a little shicker before Shabbos, but the horse knows where to take me.
Oh, that is a fantastic story.
Yeah, it is true.
Yeah, I remember he's told that story many times.
Did Percy's great horse have a name?
Oh, I'm sure it did, but I don't remember the name. He had, I know that he had a horse for a long time. The reason why they got rid of the truck, and his buggy stood up on Dufferin Street on a farm until it disintegrated for about 20 years. Mm. The reason why he got out of it is because there were no more manure collectors.
Mm. So he would have had to have taken it somewhere.
So
that was the pivotal point for him having to give up. Yes, yeah. Horse.
And basically, that was a final situation for a lot of guys with horses.
But that must have been quite a picture to see all these trucks.
Yeah.
And Percy's horse.
Yeah, it was. It was.
But that is an absolutely delightful story. Yeah. How he ended on Friday, and Percy and the horse could get him home.
But what can you say, right?
Can't, I mean,
he had it worked out. Yeah. So and another memory I have, do you remember the Eisenberg store, the variety store that was...
You know what? I'm from Montreal.
Oh, you're from Montreal.
So
okay, sorry.
I didn't come here until 1968.
Okay, so it might have still been there. It's Kitty Corner from the Harbor Bakery. So right on Harvard, Harvard and Major, on the corner, the northwest corner.
Right across from the gas station.
Yeah. Anyways, there was a there was a little Eisenberg's variety store, which where I got my mallow cones. And it was a beautiful store where you walked in. It was all wooden cabinets where they have the cards, the greeting cards. Mm-hmm. Beautifully done. And then in the back, there was a little toy section, you know, small some small toys. And then in the front, there were the chocolate bars, of course, and the gum. And keep going down, there was the three tubs of ice cream, chocolate, vanilla, strawberry.
Yes, of course.
6 cents, and then it went up to 7 cents. Oh my goodness. But I remember going in there, and outside, right outside the store, they had a gum machine, and where you could, it was Adam's Chiclets. So it was right there, and you put in your penny and in the slot and push in the slot, and you get your small gum. It was like two bits of Chiclets. So it was just sitting there. I mean, today it would probably, someone would walk off with it, but in those days it was there. But I was not a gum chewer, and I didn't even like candy. But I love those ice creams. And the occasional, I like potato chips and the occasional chocolate bar. But we weren't really into junk food in those days. The diet was, I mean, my favorite thing to eat was salami sandwiches on rye bread with schmaltz. My father would make that for me, and I loved it. And I had a sort of a savory taste for food then. Mm-hmm. And I used to enjoy my food. I used to enjoy my food.
Very good for you, too.
Right,
I'm sure. Cardiologist will absolutely agree about it.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Since you're talking about, well, one thing that you made clear is when you were younger, your community was very, very local. I mean, if you lived near college, that was your community.
Yes.
And if you lived near Harvard or on Harvard, that's who you played with.
That's it.
It changed then when you went to school, because then you, not everybody lived on your same street, of course.
Branched out a bit.
And what schools did you go to?
Well, I went to Lansdowne, right to the end, to grade 8. Mm-hmm. And then I went, I transferred over to Harvard for about 2.5 years. And I think that's the main reason I drove my parents crazy. I think I was a little bit of a difficult kid in some ways, because I convinced them to stay downtown because I was going to Harvard, because they wanted to move up to an apartment. They were trying to find a house but couldn't find one. They were going to move up to Baycrest area.
Mm-hmm. That was apartment. Far away.
Yeah, and then they were going to move up to just look for a home. But anyways, that was my career. But I stayed in Lansdowne. I was in the old school, which was a great school, and I have lots of fond memories of the girls' side. The girls' playground, the boys' playground, and we played yoki, you know, with the jump with elastics. We would tie them and we would, you know, jump over them, and lots of double dutch, skipping, and balls, and it was just great fun.
Played outside with each other.
Absolutely.
At school and in the neighborhood.
That's right. Yeah. We always had a skipping rope, and I'd do double dutch or just single dutch or whatever. Get a couple kids together and just skip, or just with a ball. And but the old school of Lansdowne was gorgeous, and I can still picture it with the old staircases and you know, ring the bell in the schoolyard. Now, of course, when I was in going into grade eight, they switched to the new structure, which was in those days stunning. I mean, incredible.
So what you're saying is, at this point, it's quite old. The new structure.
I saw it. It was looking,
like the new Mount Sinai Hospital is now the middle one.
Yeah.
Did you go to the same school?
No.
Where did you go?
I went to King Edward. Uh-huh. But it was sort of the same thing. When we left October of 1956, they were wrecking the houses north of the old school to make way for the new school. And after that summer, they destroyed the old school. And I remember it as being really, really a beautiful school. And it had a lot of character. It had the boys' entrance and the girls' entrance. Mm-hmm. And the girls' playground and the boys' playground. Now, the boys could go into the girls' playground if there was if they weren't up to mischief or something like that. You could walk in and nobody could chase you out. And we'd play marbles, like gamble with marbles.
You played for pennies? Mm-hmm. You no, say gamble?
We'd gamble with marbles themselves.
Okay.
Oh, okay. That was a currency.
That was a currency. And the teacher would stand there at recess and have an old-fashioned bell go ding, da-ding, da-ding, da-ding. And beautiful hardwood floors. And I remember the kindergarten. It was a very odd-shaped room. But I also remember, too, how regimented things were. It was post-war. And the teacher would get on the piano and play marching songs. Mm-hmm. We'd march around, single file, double file, you know. And it was very, very militaristic, regimented. We've come through in a generation and a half, two major wars, and we were in a smaller war, Korea, at the time. Mm-hmm. So I think part of the school system has always been used in some way, right from the Industrial Revolution, to indoctrinate the children in order how to become adults and fit into the where they should fit in.
So it was reflecting the times.
Yeah, it mm-hmm. was reflecting
yes,
the
I
times.
I remember the same thing, exactly.
Yeah.
And when you went in, could you just go in or did you get into lines to go up to your
classrooms? Get into lines. Always.
Well, you got into lines.
We didn't get into lines.
No, we did.
And then the thing that got me that I really didn't like is that, you know, and I didn't know I didn't like it, but I just kept on getting into trouble there. Was going to Brunswick Tomatoro after school.
Oh, that was a whole other thing. The Brunswick Tomatoro, do you know about that place?
I know about it, but I interviewed talked about it, so please talk about it.
Okay. Well, you started on, so, but I have my thoughts.
So that was on Brunswick and College?
Yeah, it was on the...
And what years are you talking about?
I'm talking about 53 to 56, went there.
Okay.
And it was after school every day except for Friday, Saturday, and Sunday.
No, you went Sunday.
But you went... Oh, yeah, Sunday.
So it was Monday through Thursday and then Sunday.
And then Sunday. Sunday, yes.
And here you are. You've been sitting in school till 3:30, crossing your hands, sitting there.
I used to sit like this.
Okay. And then after school, you had an hour, 4:30, and then you had to go into this jail room till 6:30.
The hater.
Yeah. And I call prison hater now. So
it's a lot of sitting for children,
especially for boys.
Yeah. And I was an active kid. I was very, very creative in a lot of things, and creativity was shunned upon you. It went against regimentation. So anyway, that was there. And next door to that was the Jewish Y. And you looked down the stairs and there was a swimming pool down there.
And you were sitting there learning Hebrew.
That's right.
I don't know.
And then there was a pool hall towards College Street, which only bums went to play pool in those days. And then around the corner, about four or five stores down, there was a place called Welch's Delicatessen. And Welch's Delicatessen was an old guy, Peter Welch, and he would sell hot dogs for 10 cents. So a lot of times you'd go in there, you'd buy, if you're really good, you got a quarter on Sunday before going into Hader, and you go in and buy a couple of hot dogs he used to serve the Coca-Cola from a bottle into a Eurosight glass.
It was pretty small glasses.
They were the bigger Eurosight glasses.
Uh-huh. So, that's a funny memory.
And across the road was Becker's Delicatessen, but hot dogs were 15 cents, so you couldn't splurge.
I remember going to Becker's once with my parents. That was such a special treat. We were all out outing. We were probably going to Kensington. I think my sister was with us. And we went in there for a little meal. I think I had a hot dog. My father might have had a sandwich or something. But it was like going to the grandest hotel, finest hotel for a meal today. But not even that equivalent. I can't even explain it. But I remember just thinking, I can't believe I'm in this restaurant. sitting in this booth and sort of a curved booth. You know. But anyways, getting back to the Breast of the Talmud Torah, I think just, I know you don't want me to tell the story, but your sister tells it, and I know you've told that his father begged for him to...
No, that wasn't Brunswick.
That was another school.
Okay. That was Rabbi Katzberg for my bar mitzvah lessons.
Oh, yeah, to get back in.
Oh, okay. Yeah, he threw me out of my bar mitzvah lessons.
That wasn't there, sorry. That was another place.
That was up there. No, he... What it did is we break paper clips in half to form a U, and we then take a elastic band and...
Oh, it's like the slingshot.
Yeah, a slingshot.
Homemade slingshot.
Yeah, so Rabbi Katzberg was bending over to pick up something, and his toes was right over there, so I went like that, and I was just... Because the other guys were in the class, I was just pretending that I was going to do it, but it slipped and it didn't meet. And I got him and took this.
You could laugh now, but you were probably freaking out.
Holy mackerel.
Yeah, and get out.
You never know the effect of the unconscious.
Yeah. Exactly.
You're right. You never know the effect of the unconscious.
What happened?
Well, he wasn't too pleased about getting shot. He knew it would hit him. And he turned around and he told me to get out immediately and never come back. So I didn't know. It was a long walk home, and it was a longer walk because I had to think of how do I break this to my parents.
That was close to your bar mitzvah time, right?
It was about 6 months before my bar mitzvah.
I think, and Barbara, his sister, tells a story that his father was a kind of a very meek, quiet man, had to go there begging. I don't know, he had to give a donation, I don't know. Begging to take him back for...
He took me back.
He did take him back. Yeah. But then after that, you didn't use the slingshot anymore.
No.
But anyway, so getting back to Brunswick. So the boys, I went with the girls. I went with Susie from the bakery. Mm-hmm. And I had another friend, Frances. And... Frida went. No, she didn't. Anyways, we would walk. We'd have our little walk, and we'd go down Brunswick Street, and we'd discuss. I remember we discussed the birds and the bees, all sorts of interesting topics.
At 7 years old? At 12 years old? At seven.
I think, I started around seven. That was grade one.
That was early.
Maybe I was a little bit older when we talked about that, but I remember having that discussion walking down that street. And I went till I was about... I think I stopped in grade four. So I went from grade one to grade four. Mm-hmm. And I have very good memories of Brunswick because as a girl, I could sit longer. I didn't have the same issues. I mean, but I remember the boys were always getting yelled at and kicked out and a lot of, hand stomping and teachers freaking out. And the girls were usually pretty good. But, we'd sometimes go to the washroom. We'd go in there and be silly and have some laughs. And I remember our teacher in grade two, Rabbi Gordon's wife, Mrs. Gordon, would ask us to go to the bakery. Was it Crown? Was it Crown Bakery there?
Crown Bread
Bakery on College, and to pick
that
up.
It was on Kensington.
No, but there was one bakery on
Quality.
College. Quality Bakery, and ask her just during the class, would you girls please go out and get me some buns
for her to take home after
take
work.
That's what we do. So, things that are totally unheard of today.
For sure. Well, even right now, a lot of them call their teachers by their first names. And you said Mrs. This and Mrs. That.
Yes, sure.
I don't
even know who knew. But each teacher, I used to get like really high marks and, I liked it. I mean, I didn't love it. Towards the end, it was getting a little bit...
It's a lot of sitting.
I hated it.
But most of the boys hated it. And we've met people later on in our lives who also had an experience of being there. And they all said the same
thing. But I thought I was the only one that hated it. I really did.
Yeah. Well, you didn't... In those days, you didn't talk about that with the others. You just felt... No. You kept it inside.
Yeah.
I remember going to Cheder after school in Montreal.
Yes.
And then when my children were that age in Toronto, I sent them to a Hebrew day school.
Did you? Oh. Yeah.
Because I thought sitting, getting it at 3:30 and at 4:10 you started school again till 6.
Exactly. It's a lot. And you start to resent it. You're not into it. So,
One other thing that is interesting, Kaplansky's.
Now, yes.
Yeah. That I remember up till about 1953, approximately, it was a Jewish delicatessen, Smith's Delicatessen.
Mm-hmm. So now it's back to being a yeah. Jewish delicatessen.
Everything yeah. comes around, goes
yeah.
you know,
full circle, yeah.
Full circle.
Yeah,
and anything else that you recall, any other specific interesting stories about the stores on either? Because you've both touched on stores in a.
Yeah, Good Bombs. There was Good Bombs, a supermarket.
Yes. First,
where was that?
That was on College Street, east of Borden, just between Borden and where Bellevue is.
But you say that was the first?
I think that was the first supermarket.
First supermarket I've been in.
In Toronto. Yes.
No, I don't think it was the first.
Maybe not the first. Maybe in that area.
But
for sure in that
early
area.
Supermarket.
But, you know, when I went back, you know, years later, just before Good Bombs closed off, and I took a look at the supermarket, it was a joke. Comparatively speaking, it was not a little grocery store.
It was. Yeah, I remember going in there just a couple of times and thinking,
it was relative.
Yeah,
it was relative, definitely.
And your mother used to shop there. So
yeah, my mother shopped there a lot. Yeah. And on Harvard, there was the Harvard Fish Market, and then there was a Brunswick Fish Market. And the only vendor right now there is Health Bread, and it was a lot smaller.
Health Bread? You mean, or Harbor
Bakery?
Me,
Harbor Bakery.
Yeah, it was smaller then. It was where, where Calandria is now. That was kind of the area for Harbor Bakery, and it was just a small bakery. And then they expanded, I think, in the sort of the mid-50s, I'd say.
Your family's shop there? At Harbor Bakery?
Yeah, well, ours did because we lived down there.
Yeah.
And I remember going in and buying challahs. I think they were 25 cents. I remember going the odd time I'd go in to
what
buy.
Are they now 35? By the way,
at a zero, yeah.
A plus. Susan would be a real good source, and Rafi would even.
I interviewed Rafi. He was one of the
first. They know a lot.
Yeah, he would be there. But I remember my mother going into the Brunswick Fish Market. And there was also, I'll tell you about that, but there was also Greenspan's Kosher Butcher, corner Brunswick and Harvard.
Where there's now a pottery store?
Yes.
That was Greenspan's.
Yeah.
Kosher meat.
Yeah.
I think they were kosher.
So many Jewish establishments.
Yeah. Oh, this was all
Jewish. All Jewish.
And Italians started to move in. There was one old Italian family lived across. Northern Italians, they were here way before the war. Mm-hmm. But anyways, where was I on... the Harvard, the Brunswick Fish Market. They used to have a tank there. And in a tank were these humongous carps. Mm-hmm. My mother never would buy the carp, but I'd see them pulling a carp out of the tank. And he had a bowling pin. He hit the carp over the head with the bowling pin a couple of times and then processed the carp for the person while he waited.
He killed it by whacking it with the bowling pin.
That's right.
And you saw this. It was
quite a few times.
And the carp would be kind of wriggling around and slippery.
Yeah. But I've heard people taking a carp home and being in their bathtub for...
I've heard
because they didn't want to cook it. They wanted to cook it fresh, so they would do their own killing.
They become their own shochet.
Right. What about Kensington Market? How much did your family use that?
Oh, went there a lot. My grandmother used it a lot. And it was almost all Jewish, as you know.
You should mention what your grandmother did.
For a while, she used to sell chickens. She was a middle woman for chickens, and it wasn't big. It was, she'd pick up chicken from and have it schlechted, and then she'd take it home and she would eviscerate it and do things and deliver it.
So she saved them a lot of work then. She saved the housewives a lot of work, she did all the cleaning.
Yeah. And I used to do this, I used to help her sometimes.
And what were some of your jobs when you helped her?
Cleaning out the innards of the chicken, cutting the certain spot, sticking in and pulling it out, the innards, and I remember the smell.
And?
It wasn't that bad. I mean, but I remember sticking my hand in and the innards were still warm.
Oh my God.
And that was you did it in the kitchen?
No, in the basement.
Basement.
She had a table in the basement.
So she had a little home industry.
Yeah. She was a very, always work. That woman didn't know what work, my grandfather too. It's all they did was work. I've never seen my grandmother sit down and watch TV.
So I want to talk about this home industry and come back to your grandmother for a while. She would go buy the chickens in there. They were dead.
Yeah.
And then she would
buy the live chickens to the shechet.
Okay.
I would go with her sometimes to the shechet, and they would slaughter the chicken.
Right.
And they had women there that would pluck the chickens that with babushkas on.
Yeah. Oh my God.
Oh yeah. You wouldn't believe the conditions where they schlechted these. If I were to take you 1890s to a shack and see there, it was really that thing. There was one light bulb hanging from a pendant light bulb. The shochet was there, and it was a dirt floor. Uh-huh. And what he had to breed the chicken was an old wood stove with the burners or the plates taken off. So he dumped after he slit the chicken, he dumped the chicken in there to bleed it, and the ladies would be going like that. And then after he bled them, he'd give them to the women that would sit there like this, pulling the feathers out. And they would wear leather aprons. And it smelled like crazy. But even as a kid, I walked in there, and I thought, oh my God, this is like being back before the Russian Revolution.
Yeah.
I didn't use that term, but...
Yeah, you knew that you were in a bygone era.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, it was really something.
And then your grandmother also did catering, right?
Yeah, she did catering.
So it had been killed in the way that it has to be a kosher chicken.
Yeah.
And all the feathers were removed.
Yeah.
And then you took them home.
Then he took them home, and we'd eviscerate them and wash them. We never salted them for koshering. That was left up to the merchant
that bought them.
Mm-hmm. And my grandfather, I never delivered the chickens, but my grandfather and my grandmother would also deliver the chickens. Probably made 25 cents a chicken.
You were working at a young age.
Oh, I've always worked. I've always worked. Yeah.
Was there some, this is your responsibility, you're a member of the family, or did they give you a nickel or a dime occasionally?
Yes and no. I mean, I was never, my grandfather was quite generous with me. I mean, he would hand over some spending money to me. Not a lot, but, you know, they would, no, I would be glad to help out, and sometimes I got paid, sometimes I didn't, but...
So that work was going on in your home. I mean, that's a real job.
My grandparents' home.
Grandparents' home. Anything in your home, any kind of home?
Just that, actually, the furrier, my father would be in that darkened room, and I remember even those days going down there, and it was really dark, and all these furs piled up. It was almost... And my mother remembers she used to urge him to come out and, you know, get some fresh air. But he was also, he was worried about the money situation. So he probably made a penny a pelt or something. He'd be sewing and cutting. So he did that. And then my mother later on, she did sort of touch-up photography. And because I think her cousins had this... in with the photographer, and they had these little boxes where they would the wooden box with a hole, and put the photograph in, and the two of them would be there with their pencils, and they would work in the breakfast room, and they'd be touching up. I think one of the studios was Yamaha Studios, I believe, on Young and Dundas. Yamada.
Yeah.
I think that was one studio that they worked for, but I guess it was piecework, and she did it. You know, just...
And that was your mother doing
that. That was my mother.
So your mother did the photography stuff, and your father was doing the furry stuff.
Yes, but she didn't do much. It was, and it was a little bit later on. She really just did it sporadically. Right. So it wasn't like my father who did it quite.
Okay, but you're talking, here we have three different kinds of industry happening. Yes.
Yeah. Well, my father also...
Your grandfather,
No, my father also had a side job. He worked 5.5 days a week for a while, and then it was 5 days. And he would, where he worked, it was a Marshall mattress company. And that's where he worked for about 40 years. And they would have leftover ends. So he would either get them for nothing or pay little for them. And he would then, Saturday, we'd go on Spadina, and he had some customers he'd sell it to on Spadina. And he'd take me for breakfast to Mars Restaurant before going out. And I'd get 2 eggs with some hash browns and a slice of tomato and a bit of lettuce and some toast and a glass of milk.
And then very nice.
Mars is about one of the only only establishments that's still around. And they'd go out, flog the stuff. We had a, and then he got into first scraps. So he had some customers for first scraps as well. And also occasionally he found some scrap metal. So he would do that.
Selling all these kind of odds and ends and odd things.
Yeah. Yes.
And he found customers too.
Yeah.
Just
a few extra dollars.
And most of them were steady customers. Yeah.
But you're talking about a lot of different industries.
Yeah.
Just talking about your parents and with you, your grandfather.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They also had a steam bath too, that my grandfather ran on College Street across from the Western Hospital. Misnomer, the sanitary steam bath.
That's what it was. What was it called?
The sanitary steam bath.
It's
as opposed to all the others.
Yeah.
Our parking lot. I think it makes a better parking lot than a steam bath.
And they had the women's night. And
yeah, men's night. My mother worked there. My grandmother worked there. My father, then 58, he was offered a partnership in there, and he quit his job at Marshall Mattress and then went and worked there. And that was also a Jewish hub. Now, the steam bath in the early 50s, you'll like this, was an integral part of the Jewish life. Because they had a mikveh in there.
Oh.
Okay. But also the fact that a lot of people didn't have hot water in their house in those years.
Or baths or anything.
Yeah. So they'd come once a week to the steam bath to have a cleaning. Because there was always hot water there.
Mm-hmm.
There was no baths, but there were showers.
Yes, there were showers. It was a community place. And to have a mikveh is very serious for the observant family.
So you're looking at one of the few people in the world, or in the city, that's actual father owned a mikveh.
And they used to give plates there, right?
Yeah, my grandfather used to give plates.
What is that?
Like a rub down.
With an oak leaf broom.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, you get up and lie down in the top section of the steam room, and you rub you with soap, an old European thing with soapy water mixture, and it was actually, my grandfather gave me a few of them. They were really, really incredible.
Hardworking family.
Oh, yeah.
Very resourceful. If you can think of something to do when you do it, you earn a few extra dollars for your family.
Yeah. Oh, I got to tell you one story that was really funny. When my grandmother got older, she started to have to relax a bit because of her health. And one day, we were living up in Bathurst Manor. My phone rings on a Friday night. My grandmother says to me, "Do you understand Yiddish?" "Yanko, Vusra channel is the Kantruda Oif." "Vusra channel is the Kantruda Oif." I says, "Bubba, Vus is the Kantruda? The Kantruda. Bubby, ich weiß nicht, was the Kantruda is." And she says, "The Das Wesen." So I went to the TV listings and I look.
TV Guide. Yeah.
Country Hoedown.
Oh my God.
And then
I said to her, "Bubby, the main's the Country Hoedown." "Yeah, the Kantruda." She was a country western fan.
Yeah. How funny. But before I forget, I don't know if anyone's mentioned the corner stores and what the candy we used to buy. That's an interesting part of the past that's long gone. So those little stores were pretty well on every corner. You'd have a variety store. So the closest one to us was Ulster and Major. And it's a house now. Anyways, we'd walk in this sort of a dark, straight room, and they'd have all these candies there just sitting there. I wasn't a huge candy fan, but for some reason I enjoyed those treats. So for one penny, you got three black balls. One penny. 2 cents, you get the Lick-O-Made, and it was also across from Lansdowne School was a little store. The Lick-O-Made was in a little, so sugary, fruit-flavored sugar in a little pouch with a straw.
Made of licorice.
Yeah, yeah. So that was 2 cents. And then we had the, what are those strips called? Oh, gosh, I have a mental block. The licorice. Licorice was a huge thing. I think that was also 2 cents for a stick of for the red licorice. I didn't like the black. And there were also other assortment of candies, but for if you had 2 cents, you could go. And I remember going in there once and just really debating, and the poor woman that was trying to serve me thinking, you know, she's standing here driving me crazy and trying to decide on what to buy with her penny. But that was the excitement. I remember going there once getting my mother her milk, and it was in a glass bottle. It was a hot day, and I didn't really want to go. I remember I paid 20 cents or 25 cents for this thing, and I was schlepping it back and kind of feeling resentful. And sure enough, just before I got to the house, I dropped it. I'm not on purpose. Oh my God, did my mother give it to me? I remember that. And after that, she either didn't send me again, or if she did, I think she just sent me one more time. I was so careful with that bottle. But I remember that. I don't think lessons. I was the easiest kid. I think I had my issues. although, I mean, I was a good-natured, you know, and I got along with everybody. But, I had my stubborn streaks.
Yeah. Still does.
But I remember but the candy store was a whole world in itself.
Absolutely.
That we all would just, be so excited to go in there.
They had one.
So the candy store was another place that the kids had a good time.
That's right.
The kids, the community.
That's right.
A place to gather.
And there was one usually across the school. There was one across from the corner of Van Coonet and Lippincott. There was a store owned by the Goldberg family. And they had all the cheap candies out there for the kids at school. And we'd buy our marbles there, 10 cents for 30.
So corner stores were a big part of your life.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Oh, another thing which is probably nobody will ever tell you about because it's so obscure. They used to have these little red boxes on lampposts made of cast iron. And it was had a little sort of roof, like a birdhouse, but made of cast iron. And in case of fire, you broke the glass and you pulled a thing out. I never seen anybody do it, nor did I ever do it. Mm. But that was in those days before you had telephones.
Also, that was a way to call to contact the fire department.
Exactly.
Directly.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So that was one of the last things. Remember the party lines?
Yes.
Okay.
So you had a party line.
We had a party line
for a while.
Yeah.
We did too.
Yeah.
And we had a little telephone table when you came into our house, just sitting right on this on the little landing before you go upstairs.
Same one we had.
Black telephone, and I'm sure there was a little book there with the phone numbers, but that was, where you made your calls, and, we had another phone.
And when you went to shul, everything was in Yiddish, and they used to auction off
the aliyahs.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
During Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, the erste Mol, the zweite Mol, and the dritte Mol, verkauft zu Mr. Cohen. I used to walk in, and the place had a very pungent smell. This was a Kiever shul. And the reason why is these guys here hardly wore their suits. And they were heavy wool suits. And a lot of them were in mothballs. A lot of them were never went to the cleaners. And there was this real pungent smell. You walk in and it hits you.
And they weren't using deodorant.
No, of course not.
And they didn't bathe that often.
They didn't. No one used toothpaste.
What? Did you speak Yiddish at home? You seem to speak Yiddish.
No. My father hardly spoke. He could understand and speak very little. My mother was able to speak better, but I hung around my grandparents.
So you,
And I seem to have some sort of affinity for languages. So
because you've several times you seem to speak it.
Yes, he speaks very well. Yeah. He's very good with.
So
with
that was communicating with your grandparents.
Yeah. Well, my grandmother, neither of them spoke English well. My grandfather could. They both understood it. My grandfather was a lot better at speaking English than my grandmother. But my grandmother, it's like right now you can find Italian women who came in 1952 who don't speak any English. Everything is, all their business is done in Italian.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So they would speak Italian in their younger generation might answer in English. Yeah. They could get by.
Yeah. So just Jack and his sister, his older sister, who might be interesting to interview her too, but she lives in New York.
Yeah.
I can give you her information if you like. But those two picked up the Yiddish, mm-hmm. but none of his other cousins, which are not that far off in age from him.
None of them.
He's got one that's just two that are a year younger.
Yeah.
And many others, but none of the other ones picked it up.
Yeah.
So they, you know, which is great. So he's got that he's got that language as a gift.
Yeah.
And I have the same similar thing I had because I spoke obviously German as a little girl, but then my parents spoke Polish. That was their first language for both of them, and Yiddish was, I think, a language they used kind of when, you know, maybe they didn't want me to understand. I don't know. They went into both, but I'd say Polish. You know. So now to this day, I don't speak Yiddish as well as Jack, but I've taken lessons and I was in a drama group. But I can pick it up, and I can follow a conversation, and I can actually even read and write in Yiddish. But my younger sister, both of them, one is much younger, nothing. And the Polish, I also have retained quite a bit. And I've been told that if I was immersed in Polish society for 2 months,
you would speak it again.
Yeah, because I can follow, and I can, you know, I can say certain phrases and even some sentences, but you know that, and I don't hear it anymore. But that's what my parents spoke, and my mother would have her friends over a lot as she was an entertainer.
They spoke a combination of Polish and Yiddish.
Yeah, but mostly Polish, mm-hmm. I'd say. And my mother wrote beautifully in Polish, and that was her first language. That's what she was educated in. So we picked it up, so we feel blessed that we have a little, not that we're fluent so much so, but it's just, it's a bonus.
I'm wondering if you can talk, we're going to end very soon.
Yeah. Okay.
I wonder if you can talk a little bit about the churches and the shuls in the neighborhood.
Oh, there were so many shuls. I mean, if you walked at Spadina and College, you could probably hit 15, 20 shuls in a matter of a half an hour, just doing a circuit. There was about two or three shuls on Brunswick.
Little Stieblach.
Yeah. In fact, the...
Well, Brunswick, the Nariver is still there.
Still there.
Yes.
But there was one shul just a little north of College that closed down probably only about 15 years ago. But you had to have credentials to be mm-hmm. to be a member there. You had to be at least 90 and have a white beard down there in Pippick.
So that was on Brunswick, north of College.
Yeah. Just north on the west side of the street. The shul that's on Markham Street, there was one kitty corner across from it, one directly across from it, and then there was two further down, one on the west side and one on the east side. One was also the Beth Jacob Girls' School on Markham Street. Mm-hmm. Corner Markham and Harvard on the southwest corner was a Jewish library.
Yeah. Which I used to go to.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That's on the wrong side of the tracks for our interview.
Okay.
But
Okay. And the shuls, there wasn't a plethora of shuls
On this side
on
of
this
Bathurst.
Side, on this side of Bathurst. There was just on Brunswick.
Okay, yeah.
Well, there was one, yeah, the one I went to was Brunswick and Sussex.
Yeah, the Shomer Shabbos.
Shomer Shabbos, which is now an art institute. You've probably seen it. Right at the corner of Sussex and Brunswick. They've modernized it. Mm-hmm. But that was they had the downstairs, which was probably less expensive. That's where we used to go, or my father used to go for Yom Tov. And then the upstairs was really beautiful, I remember, very elegant. And both of us remember going in there on Yom Kippur, and there was this really bad smell of bad breath.
Because, oh, yes.
Where's so that? The bad breath smell in the shuls. In the shuls,
yeah.
Where you go.
There was a shul. It's the edifice is still there. There was a shul right next to King Edward's shul on Bathurst Street. It was the forerunner of the Out of Israel.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
It was one of the first to move out of the area. I believe it moved out probably around 53.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That was a shul. There was no shuls on Lippincott. That was the only shul on Bathurst from college to Borden. I mean to Bloor. There was none on Borden.
But that's still quite a few, considering we're just talking about what we now call Harvard Village.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
The Harvard Village is up to Bloor, down to college.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I didn't know about any other ones.
Brunswick was about three or four shuls.
Yeah.
That was the shul street. Yeah. There was none on Major that I know of. None on Robert.
No.
Do you know Robert Brass and Fanny Brass?
No.
I should get a hold of them. I haven't spoken to them in many, 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 many years. They live on Robert Street.
A family?
Related to you? Mother and son.
And related to you?
Yeah. Fanny was married to my father's first cousin, Harry Brass. An infamous fellow. But you wouldn't want to know why.
Of course. Of course I would.
Okay. Up till probably, I'd say about 15 years ago, the older Jewish generation in Toronto, who were before the war here, and, you know, not the young, greener, so to speak, knew Harry Brass because he had he was known to have a humongous penis. And people, when IP introduces Jack Brass, they would, or any relation to Harry Brass, and while they do it, they'd be looking at my trousers.
Fentafane, yeah, we've had that.
It was quite a thing. And I remember I was in the Bank of Commerce where I had my business account, and the manager calls me in. And there's a rotund guy about that time in his 70s, and he says, "Phil Green, this is Jack Brass." And Phil Green looks at me and says, "Any relation to Harry Brass?" I says, "Yeah, my father's first cousin." He says, "You got a big schlong too?"
So this was a well-known...
Oh, yeah.
And probably true.
I would imagine the first wife... his first wife got an annulment because they couldn't consummate the marriage. But Fanny's still alive. She lived on Board Street for a long, long time.
Would you check with her? And
say, oh, yeah.
So where is she living now?
On Robert Street.
She is on Robert Street now.
Yeah. And Bobby Brass, Robert, lived on Borden Street for probably until the 80s.
So I'm going to ask you to check with them and see if
I will.
We could.
I haven't spoken to either of them in at least 30 years.
Yeah. Would you be willing to do that? Is that...
Well, what are they going to do?
They can say yes or no. We're going to end. I just want to talk about one thing, and that is the security, how safe it felt at that time in your experiences.
I remember a big stink. My mother was going to the Quality Bakery to pick up some stuff, and this was late at night, and she saw somebody getting murdered in front of the Bellevue Theater. And that was the big hit of the thing. It was safe.
Yeah.
Besides that, you let the kids play. There was no
issues. Felt very safe. We felt very safe. I remember one incident, though, in Lansdowne, in the playground there. We'd hung out one night. There was a few girls. So I was older already. I was about 10, probably 10, 11 almost, something like that. But anyways, just playing there. And there was this guy following us around and asking questions and this and that. And I wasn't concerned, but the girls said, you know what, we should call the police. We should call the police. So I remember going home, and we called him Mr. He. I don't know. And I remember a police officer coming to my parents' house and asking us all sorts of questions about him. So I don't remember anything else. He didn't touch anybody. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that was... and I know this is out of the jurisdiction, but on Markham Street there was a guy who was, you know, interested in all the young girls and lived next door to our house. And
I never lived on Markham Street, so...
Yeah, yeah. And he would lure the young girls up with candy and stuff, and he would throw candy down. Yeah, Andy. I remember
Andy,
I know once my sister and her friend, they were living 411 as well, almost went up there because he said, "Come on up, I've got lots of great candy." And you know, my parents weren't home, and in those days, just the way it was.
He was never known to do anything, was
yeah,
he?
Yeah, he was. He was known,
oh
yeah.
Oh.
But anyways, they never went up. They just had a funny feeling. But myself, I always felt safe.
Same with me.
We were out in the evening, and there was no...
You see, those kind of people now would get so much attention.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And at that time, you kind of fended for yourself.
Yeah,
Yeah, but what you're saying is... Both of you lived in the neighborhood, and it was a safe place.
Absolutely.
There are incidents always. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Yeah. I think it's still a safe place. I think people got nothing to worry about. It's not a case where we're living in a subsistence level. We got too much time to think about all our fears, right? Mm-hmm. Really. And, you know, when we have grandchildren... I would let them play on the street. Mm-hmm. I would have no problem with it. We sent our kids to Bialik. We lived on Strathern. They were 8 years old. Mm. We sent them on public transit to Bialik. And the other parents were looking at us.
So they would just take the Bathurst.
Yes, yeah. Bathurst bus.
Yeah. 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 Are you, is something wrong with you? You're endangering child life?
Yeah, and I just want to say before I forget about that, Jack had the Bellevue, but in our area we had the two theaters you probably heard about, the Midtown, which is now the Bloor, mm-hmm. and then the Alhambra, which was right across from Honest Ed's. So those were our hangouts, mm-hmm. and pretty well same sort of a thing. Every Saturday, if I wasn't out with my parents, sometimes I'd go with my parents to a movie, and our walks were certainly like they were, they'd always get me a treat, sometimes a little toy at Woolworth's, which was next door. I think it's Blockbuster. No, it's, there's, I think it's a dollar store next to the Bloor. But if I went with my friends, which was Susie from the bakery, yeah. and sometimes Francis, and maybe another friend, Frida, we would go, we'd have 25 cents. So our show was more expensive, 15 cents for the movie, all the movies, whatever, how, you know, you could stay there all day if you wanted. And 10 cents for the popcorn. Well, we never got a drink. But Susan always had extra money. I think her mother just gave her extra change. So she was fun to go with. And she'd treat us to ice creams and, you know, buy licorice. So we'd have a great time with her. She was...
Anyways, we better get going.
Yeah, so... Yeah, Susan, so the Midtown and the like Alhambra. It. So those were our...
We can't go...
Lots of great memories.
We can't go into... the Harvard Bakery without trepidations, because if we want to buy something, we have to fight with her to pay for it. You know? And first thing she says is, she gives me a hug and says, "You want something to eat?"
We are going to stop now.
Okay.
I think we could talk for another 2 hours.
I know.
Easily.
We should do a walking tour one day.
I'd be very happy to do that with you.
Yeah,
I would.
Yeah.
Especially with Jack, because he knows.
Especially I can tell you that I can show you one day my shortcut to King Edward Public School.
Was that through a lane?
There was a building, you know the apartment building Van Kunit?
Yes, I do.
There's a little space between the house just south of it. It's about that wide. And I figured that was a shortcut, and I'd wriggle my way through that little...
I just want to say thank you to both of you.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I learned an awful lot, very rich stories. And maybe we will do this walking tour.
Oh, I'd love to do it. I can show you a lot of the stories, like, for instance, a Corner Croft and College was a beer store.
Oh,
so I'm gonna turn this off.
Okay.